S&P 500 makes all-time highs on the biggest earnings day of the year. Plus, lumber and copper show no signs of slowing. When will it end? To make sense of this and more, I'm joined by Real Vision's Weston Nakamura. Weston, how are you doing?
How are you, Jack? Thanks for having me.
I'm doing well. I'm getting off a three-day vacation, so I'm just getting really reacquainted with the markets and the sort of the flow. So I'm so grateful that you're here to help me, explain it for me. How are you?
I wouldn't consider 3 days of vacation, and I'm pretty sure you can just catch up, but happy to do it for you. I'm well, thank you.
Okay, I'm glad to hear it. So, Weston, today is one of the biggest earnings day of the year. There were 60 S&P 500 companies that reported their earnings today. And of course, 60 in the S&P 500, of which there are 500 companies, but actually 505 stocks. We're seeing blowout numbers across the board. And, you know, that's what we've seen this week. We saw from Google, from Facebook, from Apple, we saw absolutely eye-popping numbers. I think one thing that I've got my eye on is Google. It was $15.63 was expected for their earnings per share. They actually posted $26.29. So how are you making sense of this blowout earnings season and how the market is reacting?
Okay, so when you say expected, you're talking about like 15 people on the sell side and Wall Street analysts, right? As opposed to the markets, right? So the expectations are by people who especially in this kind of uncertain environment, earnings environment, you cannot be too bullish and then overshoot and be the only one who misses. So everyone's going to kind of, you can't be bearish, of course, but they're going to be a little bit more conservative. So of course they're going to beat that much. And that's why, but the markets don't listen to them and the markets see right through that. That's why, you know, of course you get a big pop on like a Facebook or a, you know, but you're not going to get a 50% move on the stock, right? I think that's just a function of markets versus literally a handful of people who are so-called the estimates. So
yeah, I think that, you know, in the same way that Wall Street analysts, they always say that they never really put a sell signal on a stock unless they're totally convinced. Because if you put a buy rating on a stock, and you're wrong, you know, you're just wrong. That's the end of it. But if you put a sell signal on a stock and you're wrong, you could actually lose your job because the CEO gets pissed off, and you know, the CEO is the one who directs who does the investment banking work, and it's all related.
Well, you're not gonna just lose your job. You're not gonna be able to get hired somewhere else either, because that company will now cut you off from investor relations. And so if you're covering Amazon or something like that as an analyst for however many years, and then you suddenly put a sell signal on Bezos, you're not gonna get into that. So therefore, you're now useless as an analyst. Doesn't matter what shop you go to, you're not gonna no IR is going to talk to you anyway. So that's career suicide, right?
Right, and it's kind of works the opposite way for earnings expectations, as you mentioned, which is they put a somewhat artificially low bar for expectations so that it always looks like they beat it. But Weston, I actually was reading a paper, and even considering that phenomenon, this is still a phenomenal quarter for the S&P 500 in terms of earnings, because generally the 5-year median average for companies beating their expectations is about 74%. So 74% of companies beat their earnings, but for this quarter, it's 90%. So things really are heating up. And I know we had some somewhat questionable data from the economic side, but for me, Weston, it looks extremely bullish for earnings. Am I wrong? Do you disagree?
No, I don't disagree at all. I don't think, and the markets certainly don't disagree. I mean, what are we at? 4,200, right? The markets seem to have anticipated all of this, right? So, even the GDP print for example, that's a phenomenal print, but doesn't really phase the markets. What I'm thinking is, what if you get these sort of, amazing numbers out of Google and out of Apple and so on and so forth, even with like kind of shaky guidance given semiconductors and all that? Imagine, and then US GDP came out like 6%, something like that, and then the market sold off. That's, that's a possibility, right? And that means that things were way too frothy indeed and priced in, and they're just going to, there's just going to be a wave of profit taking after that. So what's happening in markets right now is what better be happening, because if they went the other way, it can cascade.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And there is some suggestion that the balloon could be off the rose a little bit with the economic data, because 6.4% annualized quarter over quarter growth, of course, that is, you know, very good number, but it was actually slightly below the expectations. I know you're probably like, oh, Jack's the expectations guy. But, you know, these are economists who admittedly do, you know, tend to work at banks. But I think the sort of actual goal was 6.7, the expectations, and it was slightly below that. Likewise, initial claims, continuing claims for joblessness was slightly above expectations, which is, of course, not what you want. So the economic data today wasn't too great. What did you make of that?
I don't know about not too great. I mean, it was pretty great from just a nominal standpoint. But I hear what you're saying. But what I'll say about what you know regarding the Wall Street banks and their macro department versus the stock analysts is that the economists will actually, because there is no United States investor relations department that they're at conflict with, right? So like, it's just, those are just the macro numbers. And if they say like, we expect GDP to be terrible, Janet Yellen's not going to come knocking down, you know, on your door or anything like that, right? So, I mean, it's, if you make a bad call, you're going to make a bad call, but there is no conflict of interest and like corporate politics involved with that. So it's more honest. I'm not saying it's more right, but it is at least done in good, you know, earnest.
Weston, let's move on to the Fed meeting yesterday. I know Peter Buchvar and Ed covered it quite extensively, but as someone who was on vacation, could you just break it down for me? You know, the headline I got is everything's unchanged, same old, just like the, you know, million past Fed meetings that we've had. Anything of note there for you?
Well, first of all, I'm pretty sure that Powell said that Copper was frothy. This is not verbatim, but, you know, it alluded to that. But no, I think that what's happening with the Fed is just, it's very interesting. Like the markets, like the Fed fund futures markets and the euro dollar futures just do not believe what they're saying, essentially. That he's saying like, we're going to continue with this easy monetary policy. Like this is what's going to, we're not going to raise rates. We're not thinking about, right? And then now you have, what is it, June 2023 priced in for a hike. And that's, you know, I mean, futures market is getting increasingly more skeptical, and they're fighting the Fed in at least the front end. So
and, Wes,
and then you have
so
the two-year yield like totally anchored down too. So
the June 2023 futures, that you're saying that the market is pricing in the Fed to raise the effective funds, federal funds rate.
Yeah.
At that date, that is pretty late though. That's not 2022. You know, a few months ago, you were hearing people say, "Oh, they're definitely going to be raising the rates by December 2022 at the latest." And tell me about also what's the delta between the June 2023 and what the Fed is, because you know the dot plot. I mean, it's far out, but it's not. You know, they're saying they're going to raise it within like 2024, right?
They're not going to say anything. They're totally on a, we are not going to raise rates, period. If we should raise rates, it will have to be a very convincing, you know, data-dependent macro environment for which we do so. This is why he keeps saying, like, you know, I'm not even thinking about. But then at the same time, you know, so if inflation is transitory is what Powell's been saying, right? Of course, it's going to be like, you know, off of these comps, of course, it's going to be some like short-term inflation. It's transitory. It's not real. And therefore, we're not going to. But by the time that you know whether or not it's transitory, like the trend in inflation, it's too late. And it's, you know, inflation has been here. It's not transitory, right? And so they have to suddenly calibrate and start hiking rates like, you know, immediately. No, they're going to have to figure out a way to signal to the market that they acknowledge that this might not be transitory and that they might start taking some action. And that's a very long process as it is. And inflation comes a lot faster in, you know, in the real world than they have in terms of, forget hiking the rates, like signaling that they're going to start hiking rates and all that. So they're in a really, really rough spot, I think. So I hope for like their sake, not that I really care, but I hope that for their sake, they are right that this is transitory and the markets are wrong about not believing the Fed.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PI, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know,
trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to. Podcasts on?
Yeah, podcast, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus? Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Weston, you talked about inflation in the real world. Well, we kind of are seeing that, at least in commodity prices. Copper, lumber, oil, these show no signs of stopping. Lumber is at all-time highs. Copper is at $449, but if you actually do it by the ton, it's at over $10,000 per ton.
That was a headline. It broke through the LME, the London. That's a very psychological key level.
It is. What do you make of the continued surge in commodity prices?
I mean, I can give you the generic answers of inflation and, you know, supply side and demand side and this and that. Here's what I'll say. So copper, if you look at actually palladium too is just on an absolute tear. Copper and palladium have been kind of neck and neck as to the metals that have just been on a straight hockey stick upwards. But if you look at palladium futures on NYMEX, and I mentioned this to you before, but like, after March 2020, so last year, after that collapse, this whole time this rally has been happening, it's been doing it on volume that is 1/4 of what it's been for the last, I don't know, several years to a decade. So it's trading at 1/4 of the, so 1/4 of the volume's left, 75% of the volume that it used to trade at, the palladium futures, is totally gone. And where it went, I don't know who it is. I don't know. But I mean, are they just speculators left? Are they just the producers, the commercials that are left? Maybe a little bit of both. But either way, though, there's not a lot of conviction at all in terms of actual volume, notional volume traded in these futures contracts. Copper did take a dip down in volume and it's kind of leveled back up. But you would think that, you know, usually when you see a move like this, there should be also a corresponding gradual increase in volume as well and open interest. And volume and open interest has been flat at best on copper, on at least on HG contracts. So they don't really reconcile with one another. You know, the volume behind it and the actual price itself. So. I don't know where this tops out. I mean, if the copper, like HG1 contracts are basically, they match up really well with China A shares. And I mean, if you get basically a pullback in China, you're going to get a pullback in copper. Until then, though, I think that what's to stop it, right?
And, you know, Weston, so you are in Japan, so close to China. For those of us who aren't as plugged into that part of the world, how is the Chinese economy doing? Obviously, not obviously, but you know, it was at the vanguard of pulling the world sort of out of the COVID collapse because, you know, they did lockdown so early. And I just remember in that, you know, May area, their PMIs were incredibly high, while the rest of the world, particularly Europe and the US, was just it was a disaster. So how is the Chinese economy faring? Because you know, you did mention that it's a key input for copper demand.
Yeah, I don't know, and nobody knows, because China's data is not reliable. What I'll say about China is, I mean, essentially, this is they've been exporting deflation for a decade and a half, right? Now they're exporting inflation. Let's see if that has legs. I don't
explain know. That for me, Weston. Explain that. What do you mean? I get the deflation thing, but when you say they're exporting inflation, what does that mean?
Well, if they're driving up prices of base metals, and they're driving up, you know, the entire supply chain, essentially, starting at the very beginning, if they're just, you know, essentially front running themselves on these on these input costs, on these raw materials, they're importing from Australia while picking fights with Australia. And everywhere else, for that matter. I don't understand, like, how it's possible that they have that much demand, especially when half of the world is still in. It's not, you know, we're not at full capacity at all, right? And how are they stronger than they were, like demand stronger than it was prior to COVID? I don't know. So the yuan being very strong against the dollar over the last, say, what's called 6 to 9 months or so, that's also been kind of troubling. I've always been fearing this, like, August 2015 sudden shock yuan deval might come, but China's is a mystery to everyone, and this is why copper is really a mystery. The one thing I'll say too about copper is that you know, there is this whole, like, so Joe Biden, he gave his speech yesterday, the American Jobs Act and this and that, right? And it's very much a clean energy driven agenda that ties into both the climate change agenda, the jobs agenda, the, you know, the infrastructure agenda, and all that, right? So if that's the case, and this is happening, this is not just Joe Biden, this is happening globally, right? But essentially, the average, I think I read this, like, the average electric car needs somewhere around 400 pounds of copper, and the average fossil fuel burning automobile needs about, like, somewhere between 20 and 50 pounds, so a small fraction of that. So, I mean, that's also if that's the case, and that's the way that things, you know, copper is basically front running EV demand, right? And so there's that. There's semiconductors. There's an actual, you know, fundamental case for it. But at what price does it become, you know, unbearable to pass on to keep passing on down to your customers, right? So we'll find out, I suppose.
Yeah, and I've also got my eye, in addition to copper and copper producers like Freeport MacMoran, there's lithium producers, there's rare earth producers, all of these inputs that will be key to electric vehicles. It's interesting, with lithium and the rare earths, you've seen a little bit of a pullback over the, let's say, past 2 months. They kind of trade like a Tesla, a proxy for Tesla, somewhat, rather than a proxy for a reflationary commodity trade. But Weston, let's turn away from commodities. Let's go into the true macro world of FX rates. You know, in bond yields, we've seen a sell-off today in bonds, at least in the U.S., perhaps related to Biden's speech yesterday. But we kind of remain in this holding pattern of about 1.5 to 1.6 in the 10-year. How are you making sense? You know, what stands out to you?
Well, here's what I'll say about U.S. Treasury specifically. So the last time I was on RBDB was actually the end of the Japan fiscal year, which ends it at the last day of March. And I think that's when we had filmed it, going into April, so the start of fiscal year, this new fiscal year. So the sell-off that you see in Treasuries year-to-date has been pretty brutal, right? Much of that, especially from February, was due to Japan, was due to the Japanese buyers of U.S. Treasuries. So Japan is the largest creditor to the United States and all that. The Japanese flow is very significant. And so the move that happened from, call it, say, 1% on the 10-year all the way through, you know, upwards, that happened beginning of February or so, until March 31st, until that year, fiscal year end point, that was much of that was, it's a momentum trade. Like, one person starts selling a lot of, you know, holders start selling, but a lot of that flow comes directly from Japan. They're basically trying to close out their books for the year, but they did it much, much earlier than they otherwise would have, because of the fact that they got caught up in the sell momentum, essentially. So normally what you would see is something around $3 billion per day of Treasury selling into at the end of like the last 2 weeks of March, right up until like April 1st, and then it reverses. That started happening in mid-February from Japan, according to the data. And so that's what caused that spike in yields. But then you see the market turn around, right? And then you start seeing buyers come in, you know, you start seeing yields come down on the long end. And that happened on April 1st. That's the new fiscal year of Japan. That's when they came in and they started buying back treasuries, again. And that's what you've been seeing up until yesterday, because starting yesterday, Wednesday, and currently until next Thursday, Japan has entered Golden Week, which is a week-long holiday. It's the longest stretch of like time off that Japan has annually. Japan is completely closed everywhere. So the Japan equity trading, JGB trading, all that. But that means that there are also Japanese traders absent from the market in international markets. So you don't have the overnight U.S. Treasury buyers, which is probably why you're seeing some weakness in Treasuries over the last 2 days. The absence of them.
But Weston, sorry, you expect that the appetite for U.S. Treasuries will resume after Golden Week ends?
It may, but what could also have happened was that prior to Golden Week, they could have loaded up, you know, as much as possible, because that's a long time, like, you know, like 7 days to be absent from the market. And so if they're trying to reposition their books and get, you know, treasuries on the books that they just sold, get them back on their books, like life insurance companies, commercial banks, whoever it may be, asset managers, long onlys, they're going to front load all their buying that they need to do, maybe like compress it like a month's worth of buying that they would otherwise have done. They're going to compress it into that, you know, right before this Golden Week period, because this is the month end for them. Like 2 days ago was the month end for them, essentially. Like today's the actual month end, but being that the holiday was coming, that, you know, so that's why you saw an excessive amount more of buying. And now that they're absent, well, look at, you can see what's happening to yields today. And so people try to like kind of compare that to like, oh, look at the market reaction to, you know, US GDP figures. It's not that. It's not that at all. It's not Biden's speech. I mean, sure, some of it can be, but by and large, it's the absence of a major, major player in the market. I have this chart that I sent over to you if you want to.
Let's do it. Yeah.
IEF is, for those who aren't familiar, is basically, so it's kind of like TLT, but it's, TLT is like 20 years, 20 year maturity and above. IEF, it targets the 7 to 10 year U.S. Treasury maturity. It's an ETF by BlackRock iShares, and it's fairly liquid. It trades on, you know, it's U.S. listed. There's also a Japan listed version of IEF. There's two of them, actually. 1656 is the is the ticker code for Japan trading. iShares 7 to 10 year U.S. Treasury ETF 1656, and then there's also 1482, which is the same thing, 7 to 10 year U.S. Treasury, but this 1482 is FX hedged. So the same ETF, but one is FX hedged, one is not, same maturity. And if you look at the chart, all I did is just, you know, I've normalized it as a percent from year date. And you'll notice that IEF, the U.S., the 10-year U.S. Treasury, essentially, is down about 6% or so at its lows in April. And that that basically is percent for percent down with 1482, the FX hedged version. That would make sense, because if it's FX hedged, it's the same thing as, more or less the same thing as buying, a USD denominated investor buying US treasuries.
Have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why?
And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
No, everything's peachy.
Maybe you've sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
510 is declaring an emergency. There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Right. So just sorry, let me explain. Yeah. So the blue line is that ETF of 7 to 10 year duration treasuries, yeah, belly
that's
of the
curve.
That's the blue, you know, that's the blue line. As we know, it's performed badly, down 4.95% year to date. And then if you're a Japanese person and a Japanese investor and you want to get exposure to that, but it's hedged, so you don't buy it, you know, in yen. Surprise, surprise, you know, it's performed very similarly, down negative 5.72, maybe a basis point there for basis point for the ETF manager. But the green line, the unhedged, you're saying that despite the fact that U.S. bonds have performed poorly in the market, because it's denominated in yen, you're actually, you know, basically even in your money, only down 35 basis points.
Exactly. People think that, like, oh, people are like getting killed in the U.S. Treasury market. Well, no, not necessarily. If you FX hedged, and essentially, if you're basically have the same exposure as a U.S.-based, USD-denominated U.S. Treasury buyer, right? So an American buying IEF. If you have the same kind of positioning as that, then yeah, you're getting killed. If, however, you are long unhedged, you know, unhedged in yen, you're flat on the year. You haven't really taken any losses this entire time on a 10-year treasury that has moved like a full percent, right? And so the bottom half of that chart is essentially what I did was the same exact chart, but I just threw dollar yen, also percent normalized year to date. And you'll notice that the dollar yen, USD JPY, and hedged U.S. Treasury from Japan, or the normal just 7-10 year U.S. Treasury ETF, they are basically mirror images of one another, right? And they essentially negate each other, which is why you have a totally flat, unhedged U.S. Treasury, year-to-date performance from a Japan perspective. So Japanese investors, buyers a lot of them are doing it totally unhedged, FX unhedged, and they've been fine. Like there is no sell-off because the yen has been offsetting the losses that otherwise would have occurred.
Right, that's such occurred. A key point. And this is something that I actually covered with Nick Correa on the exchange, which is if you had bought a European bond yielding negative, having negative yield, you know, oh my God, you're such a sucker. Well, actually, you would have done way better because you had been denominated in the euro, which has appreciated dramatically against the dollar over the past year. So sort of the world of interest rates and the world of currencies, we think of them as different, but they're kind of like, you know, it's space and time, Weston, as we you know, are close to the end, can you just quickly talk about the Bank of Japan, Governor Kuroda's recent speech, which has been called a non-event, but you have a different take. Your thoughts?
Yeah, it's not a non-event. It's not, I wouldn't say it's an event per se. You know what? I'll call it an event. So Kuroda, this guy I've been basically stalking for the last several years. You know, I've watching every Bank of Japan meeting and all that kind of thing. He did something this time that for the first time I've ever seen that really kind of freaked me out. So policy wise, yeah, no change. Slight uptick in growth forecasts and like a slight downtick, like 10 basis points down in CPI. Who cares? Kuroda, who is this like kind of like a car salesman-y guy about, you know, positivity and all that kind of thing. He's been basically pushing this, trying to sell this like my policy of like QQE, negative rates, yield curve control. We're going to generate inflation, or we're going to get out of deflation with this radical monetary policy. That was supposed to be a 2-year process starting in 2013. In 2 years, we're supposed to get 2% price stability or inflation. So by 2015 is when that was supposed to happen. It's been 8 years, and they've gotten nowhere close to that, right? And so he spent fourfold the time making excuses as to why it's not working, oil and this and that, but this everything's fine and all that. And then, you know, then the actual policy itself was supposed to take, right? This time, however, he said, he might as well have said, like, yeah, I failed. Because what he said was, we will not hit that 2% inflation target during my tenure. His tenure ends in April of 2023. That's a long time from now. So why he would say this, I don't know. It's insane to me. But you don't buy 500 trillion yen worth of JGBs with printed yen and then call it a day. Like, there's no half measures. That's unacceptable. You either buy all of it and you burn all of it, or you don't lay a single hand on, especially at the long end of the JGB curve. But you don't buy up like half of the quadrillion yen of debt outstanding and then say like, oh, sorry, like, you know, what are you gonna do? Like, sell that position in the market? You've already, you know, completely distorted the what used to be the second most liquid and active sovereign rate market in the world. So either he really did buy 500 trillion yen worth of JGBs and is mailing it in, or he's got something up his sleeve.
Weston. I just got this across the tape. Amazon reported their results. This is from the Wall Street Journal. First quarter sales hit 108 billion, a 44% increase from it's year over year, and their profits more than tripled to 8.1 billion. And then an aftermarket after hours trading, it's up 4.14%. So what is that? Like $70 billion for a $1.8 trillion company. So, you know, some big moves in the mega cap stocks, $70 billion. That's like two Dogecoins. But Weston, you and I are going to take this chat off into the exchange. We're going to hop into the Hive Mind for a little after hours session. So we want to talk about this. I want to hear your thoughts on Kuroda, which you just talked about. But also, you noticed a very interesting pairs trade or sort of a proxy thing going on between Bitcoin and a certain Japanese equity security. Can you, in 2 minutes or less, just tell the audience what that is? And then we'll get into the weeds in the exchange.
Sure. For those of you who are watching Bitcoin and who are watching Grayscale and the premium or the discount to NAV and all that kind of thing, forget all that. Look at just forget that. There's a company called Monex in Japan, right? M-O-N-E-X. They are a $2 billion market cap, very kind of small. It's like an E-Trade. It's an online brokerage company. It's one of the larger ones in Japan. They also do crypto trading.
For crypto, right? Yeah.
Yeah, they do, but mostly like equities and all that kind of thing. Their ticker symbol is 8698. This is the most accurate, I suppose, Bitcoin proxy there is out there. They trade percent for percent on an intraday basis, on an inter and intraday basis with Bitcoin. What I will say about this, whether or not it's a proxy is not a question. It is a proxy. What I will say is I wrote something on the exchange, which you're free to feel free to take a look at. But I made the case that Monex is actually not a Bitcoin proxy. Bitcoin has now become a proxy by accident of Monex. In other words, Monex is dictating price action for Bitcoin. And this is why people who are in either side, the crypto side or the traditional asset side, you need to learn each other's markets because these markets are converging with one another. I mean, they're clearly overlapping. So I make a case for that. I'm happy to share that on the exchange.
Okay, and so that post is on the exchange, and you and I right now will go to the exchange and talk about it in depth. We'll post it in about an hour. Well, Weston, thank you so much for coming on the Daily Briefing again.
Thanks a lot. Oh, I just want to say one more thing, too. UBS, add that to the list of Argos prime brokers. Thanks for the transparency, UBS.
Of course. All right. Talk soon, Weston.
All right. Thanks.